Audio. Moving along here, today we have Mark Irwin on here, and Mark's someone I've wanted to have on for a long time. Mark's a good dude. I've worked for him in the past when he was the art director at Upper Deck. We have a lot of friends in common. We're both part of Essential Sequential. And Mark has a love for metal that is unparalleled, we'll say. I probably first heard, I'd seen Mark's name in print because Mark's an inker and has inked a lot of the biggest names in mainstream comics for DC and Marvel. But my good friend Chris Brunner, who you know is an amazing artist and also a guest on Ink Pulp Audio, decided to take a full-time desk job at one point, which I think we talked about in his episode, where he was a concept artist for Upper Deck. And the art director at the time was Mark Irwin. And Chris, being the good friend that he is, was looking out for his friends when we were all trying to get our careers off the ground. And Upper Deck was doing art for trading cards. And I think this is around the time of the first Pirates of the Caribbean movie. They had a need for artists. So Chris, being the good friend that he is, put some names in the hat. I don't remember everyone he put in, but I know he put my name in and Jason Latour. We were pretty close back then, the three of us trying to get in. We did a lot of shows together. We always roomed together, and we all talked a lot. And I was just starting to teach at SCAD at the time. And Jason got a bunch of cards, and then I got to ink a bunch of cards. Now, if I'm looking back, honestly, I took that as saying my art wasn't good enough, but my inking was. And Jason got to pencil and ink himself, and of course Chris was doing the same. But it was a job, so I was happy to have it. But I think I took that one to heart, and probably stupidly so, because I know I talked to Chris about it. And it was something as simple as, well, they need someone ink here, and out of everyone's stuff I showed him, your inks were the strongest. So it was easy to fill that hole with that. And then there were other cards that needed entire art. So out of the people he had showed him, everyone could do their own pencil and inking, but my inking was okay to ink someone else. So that's the rational reality of all this. But what happens at the time is I beat myself up over it and feel yucky about it. My insecurity gets the best of me. So I guess that's a good lesson for me, and it's a good lesson for other people too, I think. Not to internalize everything. Not to find the negative in everything. So that was that. And that was the first time I worked for Mark. And I got to know Mark over the years after that. And we became good buddies. So finally, I got to have Mark on. Mark's been a fan of the podcast and a good supporter of it. And I've been wanting to have him on because I knew we'd have a good talk about metal. But honestly, I didn't know much about Mark outside of comics in terms of his childhood and his life. He seems to have his his hands in a lot of pools, feet in a lot of pools. I don't know the fucking saying. He does a lot, and he's always trying to do more. So I guess we talk about that. Maybe I can say again. All right. So, yeah, I guess I've got nothing else to really say here. That's why I'm umming. So let's get into this. Ink Pulp Audio with Mark Irwin. All right, we're on.
Nice.
So you just did your first podcast recently, you said?
Yeah, like literally last week.
What was that for?
So this guy is called the Digital Lizards of Doom, and they're in San Diego, and then they have another thing that they do in L.A. up at Meltdown.
Uh-huh.
And that's like this guy, he's like a one-man band, and he does comedy and all this stuff, and they did a podcast, and it was cool.
And how did you get involved with it?
They play at Free Comic Book Day. Mm-hmm. And I do signings at Free Comic Book Day at a local place in San Diego. And I met the guy, and he's really friendly and kept inviting me to do this thing with him over the last 2 or 3 years. And I just hadn't had time until this year, and it worked out and it was fun.
What did you like? What kind of podcast? Like, what did you talk about?
They sat me down and they videotaped the whole thing too.
Uh huh.
So they do it on YouTube.
Uh huh.
And he just asked me kind of about like an overview of my career and.
Okay.
Kind of advice for artists and stuff okay. like that. So, yeah,
okay.
It was pretty mellow.
All right. That's cool. The reason I ask is I'm trying to figure out what this podcasting thing is. I mean, I've been doing it for a while now. I know why I do it for me, and I know people get something out of it, but it's like this strange kind of new frontier where a lot of people are like, this is the future of radio. So I'm always curious to hear like what other people are up to, especially when it taps into our comics world, like what kind of podcasts are out there. In fact, I would like to maybe try to get other people who have comic book podcasts to talk with me and figure out more on that.
Well, I think like so much of this stuff is, you know, you end up talking about craft and stuff like that, which is great.
Yeah.
The thing I think that makes yours unique is you get a little more insight into the people.
Sure.
I mean, that's the thing. It's like we're all fans, and having worked in the business, you have an understanding of the craft to a certain extent.
Uh-huh.
But it's good, you know, like when you see people who you're a fan of and you kind of get to know them as people. And
I mean,
you know, like I mean, we know the same people. So sure, you're listening to your podcast, I get all excited. Oh, he's talking to Sean this week. He's talking to Andrew. You know, I get all excited. So
that's cool. All right. So tell me, you're from Southern California?
Born and raised San Diego.
You're born and raised in San Diego.
Yeah.
What's it like growing up there?
It was great. Totally different time. I'm an old man now, you know, like,
how old are you now?
I'll be 47 in July.
All right. So you're not that far from me.
Yeah.
So my perceptions of San Diego are all from visits, cause my brother lived there, and just from cons, and the weather is beautiful. It's a beautiful place.
Yeah.
But were you like, was it like a middle class upbringing, lower class?
Yeah, we were pretty poor.
So where did you live? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in a town called Paradise Hills, mm-hmm. which is down in southeast San Diego, kind of the hood, you know.
How far from the coast?
Pretty far. It's pretty far inland.
Okay.
I mean, within driving distance.
But, sure, you know, sure,
we didn't have a car. So.
But was surfing a regular part of your life growing up?
No, not when I was younger.
When did you get into surfing? Because that's a big part of your life now, right?
It is. It's a huge part, yeah. When I was 12 is when I got into it.
12.
Yeah.
You surf every day?
No, not anymore. I used to when I was a lot younger, I did. But now I'm working so much that I work till 3 or 4 in the morning sometimes, and it's hard to wake up early to go surf.
Sure. When you say work, are you talking about the inking you're doing? I mean, you seem to
mostly
be doing
inking.
A lot of stuff.
Yeah, I have what a lot
you,
going on.
What are you doing? I mean, I know you're an inker.
Yeah.
And you have a business of your own.
Right.
Called?
Creative Militia.
Right. And what is Creative Militia?
We're kind of like we're just creative services. So we do okay. a wide variety of things.
Like, for example?
Album covers. We're doing album okay. covers for The Sword and Black Cobra.
Oh, awesome.
Right now.
Awesome.
T-shirts.
Creative Militia, who is that? Is it just you?
It's really
and you great. Hire the talent that, like, yeah. you, like, contract out?
Yeah.
Okay.
I do have a studio in Costa Rica that kind of, they do a bulk of work for me. And they're kind of technically my studio, but,
How did you arrange that?
I did a signing down in Costa Rica. I met these guys, and one thing led to another, and they're super talented, and it worked out.
Do they do mostly, like, the graphic design end of things?
No. Graphic design, for the most part. I have a tangential partner who's a graphic designer himself, and he hooks me up with other graphic designers.
Okay.
But, no, the studio in Costa Rica, what their specialty is concept and development art for video games.
Oh, okay.
So we do a lot of that stuff for, like, social media games and things like that.
Okay. So that's got to keep you kind of busy.
That's
Is it going well?
It's steady.
Steady. Okay.
I wouldn't say it's huge because we don't have a sales guy. I'm like it.
Right.
Like I'm the art director, project manager, accountant, you know. I do everything. So the one thing I don't have time for is sales.
Okay. So you do that and you're also inking.
Right.
And is inking something you're doing a lot of these days?
Yeah, I'm full time. I ink Green Lantern monthly.
Okay. Who's drawing that?
Billy Tan.
Okay.
And then whatever piecemeal stuff comes in, like I still ink Chris Pacello and Doug Mankey and Jim Lee and guys like that, like on the side when there's extra work for those guys. So
when you get like Chris Pacello, now this is a nerd question, but I'm such a fan of his. When you get the pencils, is there a hesitation before you put that ink down on top?
Not anymore.
I guess you've been doing it long enough.
Yeah,
but that must be intimidating.
I've been inking him on and off since Captain America.
Right.
Because Tim brought me on to assist him early on. And then one thing led to another. And then eventually I started doing full pages over Chris. And there's the hesitation. The only guy that I really hesitate with nowadays is Jim.
I was going to ask that.
Yeah, he's by far the hardest guy. Out of anybody I've ever had to ink, he's the hardest guy.
What makes him hard? Because he's looser? I'd imagine Pacello's pencils are pretty tight.
No, Chris's stuff can be loose, but
it's simple.
You have like an understanding of what he's going for, you can kind of hit
it's
the
graphic.
Marks. Yeah, it's real graphic. Jim's stuff is so detail-oriented and so loose.
And it's so much about the mark.
And you're following the guy that I think is the best inker in comics,
which is
Scott Williams.
Right.
And you're trying to mimic Scott. It's like, can't do it,
So
you're faking it.
Right.
So it's all fast.
Scott is your favorite inker in the history of comics.
There's a lot of guys that kind of fit the bill there as far as favorite, but I think Scott is the best. I think that he is an accumulation of all the great inkers that have come before us. I think he's a guy that like can do it all.
Yeah.
And I've just watched him work so many times, and I've done backgrounds for Scott.
Sure.
I've just seen the things that he can do, and he can do what everybody else can do, except he does it better.
Right.
And his own drawing aesthetic is so strong.
What killed me was that video floating around last year of him inking. It was a Jim
Batman
Lee face. Was it Batman? It was a face.
It was a long fan. The bottom panel.
Yeah, and all these marks I had assumed over these years were quill marks, were brush strokes.
People never believe me. He inked.
It absolutely destroyed me. I could not believe the marks he was getting out of that brush.
Look closely at the Hush stuff.
Okay.
It's all, he uses like side of brush.
Yeah.
And rapidoliners to do the backgrounds.
Right.
And he just, it's a stunning thing watching him work.
Yeah. Not to get too far into inside baseball stuff, but do you know what kind of brush he likes to use?
I want to say he was using a Raphael back then, but I'm not real sure. I paid more attention to how he was making the marks.
Sure, of course. That's just some nerd talk.
Yeah.
So you've got the inking, you've got the creative militia.
Yeah.
Anything else?
I wrote a novel that I've been trying to pitch for the last couple of years.
A fiction novel?
Yeah.
Is this Jack Secret?
Jack Secret, yeah.
Okay, so I want to talk about Jack Secret a little bit. What is Jack Secret?
So Jack Secret is, it's kind of like my personal homage to the high adventure stuff I liked when I was a kid. And Johnny Quest.
Right.
It's got a little bit of Harry Potter to it, but not much. I like magical things. I like adventure stories, and I wanted something that something that I would like to read. Mm-hmm. So I kind of...
Was Spielberg an influence, like some of his
early
stuff?
A little bit of that. I think for me, I started writing it not knowing what I was doing. And
Was it always a novel, or were you going to do a comic first?
No, it was a novel. Oh, okay. I always wanted to write a novel, and I sent the first couple chapters to Dan Panosian, who's a friend of mine, and I wanted his opinion.
Yeah.
And Dan read it, and he called me after he read it, and he goes, I want to draw this. And when he said that, it was like, oh, I think I'm on the right path, you know, for Dan to say that, because he's a guy.
But he wanted to draw it as a comic.
No.
Or illustrate the novel.
He just wanted to illustrate the novel. Okay. Yeah, he was really into it. And with his encouragement, I kept going, and I've been rewriting it and reworking it ever since.
You've been doing this for a while.
Yeah, I've been working on it for a long time.
I mean, I remember talking to you about Jack's Secret a while ago. Yeah. But you're getting it right.
Yeah, I want it to be right. And I've had so much advice from a lot of different people, literary agents. And Dan and I met with a couple of Hollywood people that were really interested in it as a property. And, you know, just you start finding out what people are looking for, and it helps you craft the thing that you're building. So.
Have you always been... I guess entrepreneurial is the word. Like always, like never. I want to say this: have you never been settled with one thing? Like you're always trying and branching out other stuff.
Yeah.
Were you like that as a kid?
Yeah, short attention span. You know, I wanted to be a pro surfer when I was a kid. I didn't want to be I had no plans to be a comic book artist. I just was the guy that drew Eddie from Iron Maiden on my math homework,
you know, like as we all did.
I didn't really know what I was doing as far as getting into comics went, you know.
Where do you think that comes from, that always just wanting to, never being settled with one thing and always wanting to, having an urge to, like, what I'm trying to get at is, I'm like a hyper-focused person where, like, for me, drawing comics is about all I can do, but I do it 110%, and I've added this podcast, and it's so with two things I get a little overwhelmed,
right?
But I do everything like Conan, like I just go at it with everything I have. I'm not the type of person that can do a little bit of this, a little bit of that, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. So I think like what my struggle in life is to figure out, because you know, on top of the podcast, on top of the comics, I've got, you know, the kids, I've got a wife, family, yeah. And I do like to exercise. So I've got all these things that I'm always fighting to figure out how to get everything in balance. And so that train can ride smoothly. And I know that's a futile thing to attempt to achieve, but it's very difficult for me to find, to be settled in life without that. So, But then I look at someone like you, and you seem to do very well with having a bunch of things you're dipping into all the time.
Well, yeah, and I wouldn't say like you know, my life's all that much in balance either. I mean, inking is inking, and I do the best job I can in the time that I'm allotted, and it takes a majority of my time. I mean, I would say
so
that
the
majority
the bulk
of my day
of your
is
time.
Inking. Yeah,
okay.
And all the other things. Like I know, I've been an art director, you know, for
right. Pretty
big companies in the past. And
so Upper Deck and who else?
Heavy Metal Magazine.
When were you an art director for Heavy Metal?
Right out of art school. That was my first job out of art school.
What year?
95.
So was that when Kevin was throwing money all over the place?
I think it was right after that.
After that collapsed?
Yeah. But he was great. I mean, he treated me. He still treats me like so well. He's a great guy.
How did you get that job?
Adam Kubert. I went to the Kubert School.
Oh, okay.
And Adam Kubert came to me right before graduation, and I worked in the Kubert School art store.
Oh, okay.
And Adam's offices were down there, and he came to me, and everybody knew I was jonesing for a job. I was looking for work, and I had already had my first kid, and I was freaking out.
How old were you?
I was 24. Five at that point.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay.
And he asked me if I knew how to do paste ups and mechanicals. I kind of bullshitted. Oh, yeah, of course.
You have to in that first job.
Of course, yeah. And I'd taken the class at Kubert, you know, so yeah, sure. I knew what I was doing. And he said, hey, you want the job as art director? And it turned out, I didn't know this, but all the stories that were printed in Heavy Metal were European stories.
Right.
So they would translate them and then they would send the translations to Adam. And Adam was hand lettering everything in English.
Adam Kubert?
Adam Kubert.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know that.
That was like a side gig for him. And
was heavy metal in Los Angeles at this point?
New York City.
Oh, okay. It was still in the East Coast.
Yeah.
I want to talk about that, but let me back up a second. So you were in school. Were you married at the time, or she was your girlfriend?
She was my girlfriend.
And is she from San Diego too, or you met her in Jersey?
Originally from Pasadena, but she went to school at San Diego State, and that's when I met her.
So when you went East Coast to go to Cubert School, did she move out there with you?
No, she stayed on the West Coast.
So you were at home.
I came home for a summer and
dropped a seed. Yeah. Went back to school.
Yeah.
And how far into school did you find out she was pregnant?
I found out. I think that summer, we found out pretty quick.
How long is the Cuber program? Is it 2 years?
It's 3 year.
Three year. School, yeah. So 1 year into school, you found out she was pregnant?
Yeah.
So then what do? Because she's going to have the baby while you're still a student, yeah. And she's on the West Coast and you're on the East Coast.
It was rough. And not to beat a dead horse, but we were poor. I mean,
sure.
Like dirt poor. And I worked full-time when I was at the Cuber School. My first year, I worked at like the local ShopRite, stocking shelves at the graveyard shift every night. And just barely making it by. And when she had the baby, she actually ended up moving from San Diego to Mississippi, where her mom was living. Her mom's husband was a chemical engineer down in Mississippi. And so she went and lived with them and stayed with them so that she could raise the baby without having to worry about it. And I would take the Greyhound from Dover, New Jersey, down to Mississippi to visit her.
How long of a bus ride was that?
It's like fucking almost day and a half or something.
That was crazy. Awful.
Yeah, it was horrible. And I didn't obviously do it too often, but I did it on the holidays and stuff like that. And then she came up to Jersey a couple times as well to visit me.
How did she get up to Jersey?
She, I think, took the train or
with the baby
as well. Yeah. With the
baby.
Yeah.
That's a trip.
Yeah.
Okay. So the heavy metal gig was probably a big sigh of relief because it was steady.
It was sweet. Yeah. It was cool because, the offices were awesome. I grew up on heavy metal. It was like a dream come true working there. But it didn't last long because literally the day I started there, I got an offer from Wildstorm to join their internship program.
The day you started heavy metal?
The day I started heavy, because I'd been applying all this time, sending out inking samples and all that kind of crap. And so it was a chance to go home. Yeah.
So you took it?
I did take it.
So how long were you at heavy metal?
About a month.
Oh, wow.
And
you left on good terms?
I left on great terms, because not only did I finish all the projects that they asked me to do, I also put in a computer system for them. They didn't own computers until I started working there. And I helped install all that. And then from that point, I brought in another guy from the Cubert School to replace me.
Oh, good.
So like I didn't leave them in a lurch, you know.
Do you have any crazy stories at heavy metal?
The only real crazy story is the first project I ever did for them was a coffee table book of nudes of Kevin's ex-wife, Julie Strain.
Right, yeah.
It's only art if it's well hung. That was my very first project for them. And then we shared the offices with Penthouse.
Okay.
So like Penthouse Letters, Penthouse Forum. So I was like, my roommates loved me because every night I'd come home on the train with like a backpack full of heavy metals and a backpack full of porn and hand it out to everybody as I walk in the door. Hey, guy's waiting for me at the door. Like, here he comes. It's
were
Santa
Penthouse
Claus.
Models coming in and out of the place, or no, this was just the publishing?
It was just the publishing end. But we were right next to Lou Reed. Lou Reed's publishing offices were literally right next door to us. Yeah.
Were there any artists coming in and out of heavy metal?
No, man. It was weird. I think they were trying to figure out who they were at that time.
Okay.
Like I came in as the art director, and of course my goal was like, I want to hire freaking Mobius, and I'm ready to bring back Barry Wrightson, and you know, like I was getting all, dreams of grandeur, and they were like, slow your roll there, pal. You know, we're reprinting all this like stuff that nobody's ever heard of from Europe. You know, like, okay.
Maybe when we're done, I can get this, but I want to email Kevin. He printed something of mine. My first job was doing this miniseries at Wildstorm.
I remember. You followed us on our book, Resident Evil.
Us? You were
I worked on the Resident Evil comic magazine.
Oh, on the magazine. Right, right, right.
And
yeah.
You did the Fire and Ice mini, right?
Yeah, after Lee Bermejo after got the Superman Gen 13 and dropped out. Okay, yeah. So I've said it before, so no need to go through it again. But for 10 years, I couldn't get another job. But what I did was I did a sample because my style had kind of changed really dramatically from a very, like, Kevin Nolan, Al Williamson, more very rendered, realistic look to a very simple cartoony, like Bruce Timm look. I was finding myself. And I did like a sample story to bring to San Diego to try to drum up some work. And it was a whole story, like 8-page full story I wrote and drew. And that's when I was interning under Andrew, and Andrew kind of helped me along with it. So I went to San Diego and I was showing it all around. And I was such a fan of heavy metal, I just thought I'd show it to Kevin. Well, Kevin loved it and published it. Nice. And these are just sample pages I did. So I would really like to thank him, because that was at a point where I needed something. And that wasn't just something that was huge. I mean, I was in Heavy Metal magazine, and I wrote it too. So I'd like to...
He's a great guy. I mean, I quit, you know, like I left them. To go work at Wildstorm, and literally that summer was San Diego Comic Con. Kevin called me and said, "Hey, can you come and work the Heavy Metal booth, because we're releasing the Joey Strain book, and Joey's going to be at the booth, and we want the whole team there." So I'm like sitting there with Bisley.
Wait, what year was this?
95.
Okay.
So I'm sitting there with Bisley and Martin Emond before he passed, and Julie. And Kevin, you know, and I felt like a freaking rock star.
Sure,
you know?
Of course.
And Julie's wearing like crazy leather outfits and boots that are like 12 feet tall. And it was awesome, you know. And they gave me a leather jacket that had Captain Stern like emblazoned on the back.
That's
and
awesome.
It was treated me so well. And Kevin's always just been so nice to me. You know, he's a great guy.
Yeah. I've got that about him. So then you went to the Wildstorm internship program.
Yeah.
And who was in your class with you?
Let's see. It was me, Rich Friend, Jason Johnson, Edwin Roselle. Trying to think who else was part of that group. J.J. Kirby.
Uh-huh.
Ryan Odagawa.
What does J.J. Kirby do these days?
I'm not really sure. I know him and Ali Garza, like, I think they're doing like covers and stuff for like Xenozoic and places like that. Or I think that's what they're called, Xenozoic.
I guess you were probably the class before like Eric and Ali Garza and those guys.
Yeah.
So just for those that don't know, explain what the Wildstorm internship program was.
Well, for me, what it was they paid a small, very, very small salary, and they put you up in an apartment, literally right down the street from Wildstorm. And Wildstorm's old offices were in La Jolla,
right?
Like right above the ocean.
Yeah, I visited there a few times.
Gorgeous place. And so you lived in the apartment, and you came in every day, and you just worked on whatever they gave you. And at the time, they had a consumer products department.
Right.
The consumer products department was doing a game called Wildstorms. So when I was first hired there, that's what all of us were doing. We're Wildstorms trading cards, you know, like small pieces of art.
Right.
And then they started slowly parsing out like stories. So like, you know, we get to like Team 7 pinups or the swimsuit pinup or whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, like I remember inking Tom Rainey on like this huge double page spread that was for a swimsuit issue, you know, sort of thing. And
were you ink focused at this point?
I was ink focused coming out of school. Basically, after my first year at the Kubert School, I was determined to be an inker. Okay. I got work during the summer of my first year as a background guy for guys like Mark McKenna.
What drew you to inking?
So I go to the Kubert School, and I think I'm hot shit, like every kid out of high school does. You know, it's like, I can draw Iron Maiden to Eddie way better than anybody I know. I must be awesome. So I go to the Kubert School and find out, like, no, you actually have to know how to draw, like, buildings and, you know, regular people and, you know, all kind of shit. And
yeah.
It turned out that I can draw, but I was so slow. And it was so hard for me to focus on being able to draw this kind of stuff.
Right.
You know, like, I was really good at drawing monsters and dudes with big muscles, but I couldn't really do
draw someone
else
buying
well.
A cup of coffee.
You know, and it was a struggle for me. But inking, like literally the minute my hands touched a brush, and I had never done it before, but I knew how to do it. You know, like I just picked it up pretty quick. And when I came home for the summer that summer, and I went to Comic-Con and I walked around, I had my terrible portfolio with me, and I had lettering samples and inking samples. And I got work immediately.
Okay.
Mark McKenna hooked me up, and I got lettering work and inking work. And I was like, oh, I guess I'm an inker.
Okay. So okay. So it just worked out that way.
Yeah.
Talk to me about why is surfing important to you? What did surfing, like, I just, my brother's a surfer, and I know a lot of surfing people, and it's a religious experience, it seems. It seems like there's something going on there that you can't comprehend unless you do it.
Yeah, I mean, damn, man. It's...
Is it primal? Is it just this, that you are at the mercy of nature?
For me, personally, I am always... My brain, like you talked about the entrepreneurial thing, uh-huh. That's the way I'm always thinking. So I wake up and I'm already trying to figure out not only what I'm doing for that day, but how the things I do for that day are going to affect tomorrow.
Sure.
And how I'm going to make money next week. And, you know, I'm always thinking of those things. Yeah. I got a kid in college. I got another one about to go to college. And so I'm always doing like all this shit. How am I going to pay the bills? You know, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, I understand that.
So when I surf, it is like one of the very rare times that I'm in the moment.
Right, right, right.
You know, like I'm sitting in the water, waiting for a wave, you know, in the, especially when cause I like to go early in the morning and, you know, the sun comes over the horizon, you can feel it warm in your back, you know,
and
you'll see like the hump of a dolphin, you know, like right next to you, swimming under your board, you know,
sure.
Sort of thing. And, you just can't beat that, you know?
You look
over, you see a buddy, you know, catch a wave, and, you know, you're giving each other hoots and stuff.
What's it like when you're on the wave? I mean, that's got to be, you're forced to be in the moment like nothing else, I'd imagine.
Yeah, well, and every wave is different.
Uh-huh.
So you're like literally as you're riding, you're figuring out how to ride it, you know? It's
uh-huh.
like, because it's all dictated by the way the wave breaks. You know, some waves you got to cruise real fast. Some waves you can stick your hand in and maybe get a little head barrel, you know, things like that, you know, or some waves you just want to beat the shit out of, you know, like, oh, this is the chance for me to really get up and smack the lip, you know?
Uh-huh.
It's all in the moment.
So it's your Zen, your meditation, you're clearing your mind.
My wife actually gets angry with me if I don't surf on a regular basis. Cause she says that I get so stressed.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. I think for me, that's what I get out of yoga. When I'm in it, there's nothing else in my brain but what I'm doing, and it clears my head. And if I miss, like the past few weeks have been so crazy on the meeting this deadline, I had to take off yoga for 2 weeks, and the anxiety and the stress just barrels over me. But it's funny, like when I'm done and I come home from class, I feel like I've had like 3 Xanax, and I'm just jello, and my mind is clean.
Yeah,
but it seems like surfing's that same sort of thing.
Absolutely, absolutely. Nothing like it.
So, how often do you surf now?
Just not enough. If I'm lucky now, I'm getting out once a week. You know, it really depends.
Is that hard? Once a week? Is that enough?
No, but at the same time, I'm on a monthly book, and
and
the guy that I'm inking is he's a good artist, but he puts down everything, like every page is.
Does that frustrate you?
No, it doesn't frustrate me. I mean, I know it's kind of the way of the world, and to be honest with you, I think especially on the fan side of things, fans are attracted to books that they, you know, quote unquote, have lots of detail, and so they go after those books and. That's how we make royalties, you know. So
sure.
That's what
I guess talk to me about where you see inking going. This is something I think about a lot. Like I feel like, the people dipping brush into ink, it's becoming more specialized, and it's like it used to be the standard,
right?
And now it's not the standard, And it's, you know, even people that are inking traditionally, more and more people are using pens than brushes, or, you know, not using nibs like they used to.
Right.
So I feel, for me, I feel like this is a tradition, and that the people still doing it and keeping it alive and promoting it are keeping something special going. Talk to me about how you've seen the shift and what you think.
Well, I think right now in comics, we're seeing a seismic shift. And I talked to a couple other people about that this weekend, actually. And it's... I don't want to say anything that sounds like I'm insulting any group, because I'm not at all.
No, no,
I totally appreciate...
Just
like,
be honest. Yeah,
things.
No, I have nothing against... Like, there's people who work in... totally digitally, and I love their work. Yeah, I'm not speaking against them. I'm just speaking about what we do.
Right. Well, what I was going to say is that I think we're seeing a huge influx right now into mainstream comics, you know, Marvel and DC, of a lot of independent creators.
Sure.
You know, people that have done their own indie titles, you know,
right.
that sort of thing. And from that aspect, I think it's awesome, because they bring a new voice, a unique voice, and sometimes a lot less idealized voice, like a more real voice.
Uh-huh.
And I kind of like that, you know? But at the same time, I think a lot of those people, because they started in indies and they're used to the fast and furious way of doing it yourself, and maybe using Photoshop, you know, throughout or whatever, that the craftsmanship
uh-huh.
and the draftsmanship is not what it once was.
I think
some of that has changed.
I kind of feel like right now, I think comics is more creatively diverse than it's ever been, which I love.
Yep.
But I also feel like right now, style is becoming more important than anything. Just, and when I say style, I mean just by the glance of something.
Yep.
And you know, for me, like, I look at a lot of the stuff that's coming out that people kind of buzz about, and stylistically, upon first glance, it's different, it's fun, it's interesting. But when I look at it further, everything you said, I agree with. The craftsmanship is not near professional level. The drafting is not near professional level.
Exactly.
And the choices in terms of line weight, if they are digitally inking, it's almost like... Like, I saw this as a teacher. Students started using Photoshop to ink with. And you can get decent results with Photoshop to ink, but you've got to get outside brushes. What it became was just a quick way to turn your pencils into black lines. And the craft of the choices being made in terms of line weight, texture, atmosphere, are all just don't matter. It's
right.
just this throw it down. It becomes... I don't want to say a sketch, because even when I'm sketching, I do think about those things. But I do see that absence. And that concerns me a little. And from my perspective, the worst thing I see suffering is storytelling.
Right.
Where I do see a lot of the style stuff going on. And the craftsmanship of storytelling is just... It's disappearing in a lot of this new hot stuff. And what scares me about that is that's what happened in the 90s.
Right. Yeah.
And it's almost like all these people doing it are rebelling against the look of the 90s, but they're almost embracing, I don't know the word, they're embracing what the 90s were. It was art over style over everything. But
right.
they're like, that style is cheap and old looking. This is the new style, where it looks...
Well, they're not cross-hatching everything.
Right. Well, it's very influenced by cartoons and stuff of that nature, where it's
right.
flat, graphic, cartoony. But the craft of the comic is missing. That's what worries me.
Think about anyone from Bill Watterson.
Sure.
Through somebody like, say, Wally Wood.
Uh-huh.
If you look at that stuff, part of what made that storytelling so great is... A modern guy who does it actually pretty good is Jeff Campbell.
Right, right.
Putting facial expressions on people.
Yeah.
And
acting,
and
staging. Staging is almost
acting is gone.
It's yeah.
just straight ahead shots. A lot of times it's and on one hand, I think in many ways the stories themselves are better now.
Yeah, like I agree.
There's because like we were I said, talking about this last night. Voice, the right. realistic voice.
And also the artists in the 90s where they became just showy artists bottomed out the industry, and then the writers got their shot.
Yeah.
And for the better.
Yeah.
Although I think right now it's becoming a little more dangerous with that aspect of things.
Well, I think that people have forgotten about artists right now, and that right. bums me out a little bit.
It bums me out a lot.
Look at Andrew on the Fifth Beatle.
Exactly.
Talk about a guy who deserves all the credit.
When you look at a comic and it's like 8-9 panel pages every page, and the writer's just trying to show what they do, you don't understand what a comic is as a writer at that point. One of the things suffering on all ends I see is page design.
Oh, yeah.
You know, really understanding what a page is, what the real estate of the page is, how you divide the page up to pace the story. I mean, I always taught to my class, it's a good idea to think of your panels as a royal family, and you can't have them all fighting for attention, so you've got to have the king, the queen, all the way down.
Well, you know, you establish your location. You establish the mood with that location. You establish the scene, then you work out of that. You know, like I can't recall like the last time I saw a great establishing shot, you know, for a story, you know.
Yeah. Oh, there's people doing it, but it's fewer and far between.
Yeah.
And I think Becky and I may have touched on this yesterday, but the writing thing is getting problematic because I almost feel like there needs to be a course that artists teach writers on. Here's what we have to consider. I mean, I remember Sean and I were talking, and Scott on the Wake had wrote like this, I don't know if it was a splash page or a double page spread. He's like, thousands of mermaids, you know, descend upon. And Scott in his head is like, this is awesome. Sean's going to have a blast drawing this. And then all Sean's seeing is thousands of mermaids. Like, what the fuck? So I remember Sean told me him and Scott talked, and Scott like was like, oh, I thought you would get excited about drawing all this. And Sean's like, it's exciting, but that's a lot of time. Like,
right.
My timeline, like, it's easy for you to type 1,000 mermaids, and then 3 days later of me drawing mermaids.
Right, right, yeah.
That's the type of thing I think. I think there needs to be a better balance. There was the artists had their turn, the writers have their turn now, and the shift is kind of.
I would like to see things kind of come back to the median because the reality is that I think a lot of comics are great, and we all love it. That's why we do what we do. But I do think that they're. And I know I'm biased, but I do think inkers should be more appreciated. I think artists should be more appreciated. You know. And I would like to see more of that, but, you know, if you're listening to us out there, fans.
They're listening. All right, well, there's now we have to have the talk now.
Okay.
All right,
the talk.
We've been waiting for this.
Damn, Dad.
No,
we have to do this publicly?
So growing up,
yeah.
I mean, I know the answer to this, but let's get it out of the way. Was hip-hop ever a part of your life?
I would say that I was aware of it. And I definitely had, I mean, I grew up in a predominantly black neighborhood.
Okay.
And, so it was around me, and I as a kid in the '70s, I loved a lot of R&B and stuff like that. Hip hop though, like for me, like when it hit big, it was at a time when punk and metal were so big to me.
Oh, they all hit at the same time for me.
And I had like a fairly rough young life. Not good. Not in a good way. And
what was rough? if you don't want to talk about it, we don't talk about it.
Well, just we grew up really poor. I grew up without a dad, and a lot of shit happened to me at a young age that should never happen to anybody. And it just made life really bad for me. And, so I was looking for, I was angry, you know, I think metal and punk really gave me like that 1-2 punch of like ways that I could lash out.
Right.
You know? And,
did you get in a lot of fights?
When I was young, I did.
Yeah.
And, got in a lot of trouble, did a lot of shit that I shouldn't have done. I mean, was doing drugs and drinking like at 12, you know. I mean,
what kind of drugs were you doing at 12? Like just weed, or were you getting
smoking a lot of weed? But at that time, I think I was, that's like seventh grade or whatever. There was a lot of speed going around.
Oh, in Southern California, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was all
pills,
so there was a lot of that kind of stuff, and yeah, it was just a bad time. And I think for me, like hip hop, the only thing that I really seized upon with hip hop was Public Enemy.
I was just going to say that. I was like, how is Public Enemy not helping you with your anger issues?
Yeah, you know, and like I totally got those guys mm-hmm. and, you know, was down with that. But that's about as far as it went.
Uh-huh.
And because I was so into the metal stuff. And
right.
I mean, I still loved guitars and, you know,
soaring
vocals and all that kind of crap, you know. And so I never totally got into hip hop.
Okay, you know? But you did get into punk rock.
Yeah.
Like what bands?
Back then it was like
You're talking L.A. punk scene?
A little bit L.A. punk scene, the SoCal punk scene, you know, mm-hmm. so you had like Agent Orange, TSOL, right. Dead Kennedys.
Uh-huh.
Dead Kennedys were real big for me back then.
Circle Jerks, Southern California?
Circle Jerks were around, Minutemen.
Yeah.
A little bit of Black Flag, you know.
Yeah,
It was kind of like that.
Have you listened to Henry Rollins' podcast?
I've listened to it a few times. Yeah. I actually saw him filming his history show.
Oh, really?
He did an episode in Carlsbad, which is right up from San Diego.
I just discovered. I mean, he's only got like 14 episodes out, but I love listening to it.
Yeah, the dude's
such
so
a
intense.
Storyteller. Yeah, and he's really lived. I didn't realize him and Ian like grew up together like that.
Yeah,
stories of those
two. Dave Grohl grew up with those guys too.
Right, like, right.
Like that always cracks me up. You know, just thinking about that whole like little.
Yeah,
I mean, it's talk about. Percolating madness, you know?
Sure. So you were into the punk, but metal spoke to you more than anything.
Metal was the biggest thing for me. Yeah, there was a show in San Diego that was on Sunday nights on like the local rock channel, called Metal Shop, and I think it was a nationally syndicated show. But I remember a buddy of mine. I was into Maiden. Iron Maiden was kind of like the band that
they were the first. They were your first favorite. Mine was Priest.
Yeah, and Priest was right after that. Yeah, and. But
so are you talking, was it Number of the Beast that got you into Maiden?
Killers.
Oh, Killers, original singer.
Yeah. Okay. I love Paul Di'Anno. You know?
That had a punk, almost like metal sound to it.
No, that's what I because I love both versions of Maiden, but the early stuff, what I loved about it was that punk vibe.
Like
Motley Crue's first album.
Yeah.
I'm not a Motley Crue fan.
Right.
But that first album is so fucking good. It's so underrated.
Was that Shout at the Devil?
No. Too
Before
Fast for
that.
Love.
Too Fast for Love. That was before Shout.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that album, what I loved about it was how underproduced and raw.
Right.
And almost punk. It's like a punk album.
Right.
It's like a speed punk album. You know?
Right.
So, but yeah. And anyway, Metal Shop. So I'm listening to Metal Shop, and this is back when I'm into Maiden and stuff like that. And the guy comes on, and the first song he plays is The Conjuring by Megadeth. I shit my pants. I was like, oh my, this is the greatest thing I've ever heard in my life. And
do
from
you
that
still
point
like,
on,
do
I
you
was
like
hooked.
Megadeth?
I love Megadeth.
I've tried
I've seen them eight or nine times.
I could
times
never
live.
Get into Mustaine's voice.
That's what I love about him. I love that anger and that the way he bites off his words. The guy is actually a pretty underrated vocalist. If you hear the way he sings
good.
Some of the songs, listen to Lucretia. Holy
no,
shit.
I know,
the way
I know,
he sings,
I know
man.
He's
it's
good.
Nuts.
I just didn't like it. Like I tried.
I know a lot of people that feel that way about
Megadeth. When I was really getting into metal, and it was, you know, I was really into Kill 'Em All, Ride the Lightning, Master of Puppets.
Yeah.
My friend was like, gave me Peace Sells It, Who's Buying. He's like, this is the next thing. And I put it on, I loved the music, but I just, the minute he started singing, I was like, no, I can't do it. And I tried, over years, tried, and I can't do it.
No, I understand. I mean, a lot of people have mixed feelings about Megadeth. I mean, you know, like I've heard Kerry King call them guitar nerds, you know, shit like that.
I don't mind that.
I'm a huge Megadeth fan. And to be honest with you, if you look at the way things have come full circle, Megadeth out of the big four is like, I think along with Slayer is like the band that's really held the metal flag high.
Who's the four you're talking about?
Megadeth,
Metallica,
Anthrax, Slayer,
and
Metallica. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I love all four. I mean, that's
sure.
That was my germination period. You know, those four bands coming up. So.
So, you discovered Megadeth, and that was it.
Yeah. Once I got into Megadeth, and I had a friend.
Had you heard Metallica yet at this point?
That leads into my Metallica story.
Okay.
So, you know, back then it was all tape trading. Right. You know, that's how we all learned about the new stuff. And I had a friend who was like my Iron Maiden buddy, you know, but his family, his mom and dad, like basically spoiled the shit out of him. So the guy like lived in his room, sending away those catalogs to like, you know, Sweden and, you know, Norway and shit. And he'd get all these like vinyls of bands I'd never heard of. And he'd make tapes for me. And he's like, dude, you got to check this out. And he hands me a tape of, I think it was Ride the Lightning. Mm-hmm. And I listened to that and I was like, oh my God, you know, Fight Fire with Fire became the song I listened to before wrestling matches, you know, like it was like, that's what I was totally into it. And then he made a tape of Master of Puppets for me. And I'm laying on my bed and Battery comes on, you know, in the beginning of it, the acoustic thing. And I'm laying in my bed and I'm like, why does everybody say that this is so heavy? And all of a sudden it's like, and I flew out of the bed and I was like, oh my God, you know, and like from that point on, dude. And
dude, metal, there's something, it's so just visceral, like it just hits you, or you just, all you have to do is sit with a friend and make a face and grit your teeth and throw your devil horns up. I get it, you know, and that's all.
And the whole thing with hip hop, you know, for me was like, you know, I went to, like I said, a predominantly black junior high and high school, and you know, and that was back when people were like throwing down cardboard and break dancing and all that kind of stuff, you know, and I couldn't do any of that, you know? Like, and so for me, it was like, okay, this has got to be my music. And I grew up in the '70s, so I liked rock, you know. I mean, I liked Rush and, you know, Deep Purple, and, Zeppelin, and you know,
Zeppelin, hell yeah,
yeah.
Excuse me,
but there you go. I'm a metal guy.
Yeah,
as you know.
So, what did you? There was kind of those dark years for metal, I guess, the hair band years.
Yeah.
And then kind of, I guess, Guns and Roses kind of pulled back out of that a bit.
I hated Guns and Roses when they first came out.
You didn't like Appetite?
No, I thought they were an overrated bar band.
Do you like them now?
I tolerate them now, but I'm not a huge Guns N' Roses fan. To me, it was like you said, it was a dark time for metal.
Yeah.
And you know, for me, it was like, man, Rust in Peace, which I think is maybe the third or fourth greatest metal album of all time, had just come out. And I was like,
that's Megadeth?
Yeah, Megadeth. Yeah. And I'm like, why aren't people talking about, like, holy, this is like some of the greatest. But everything was the Poisons and the Trickster,
yeah,
and
right,
all that
right
kind of stuff. And so for me, I was just searching for all the lesser known stuff. So I was like getting into Armored Saint and, you know, Metal Church and all. You
right,
know, like I was kind of following all those kind of like a more underground band, Exodus, and, you know, trying to just find like something that wasn't hair, you know, hair centric or makeup centric, you know. And so I was kind of moving away from that stuff. And then when Guns N' Roses came out, it's like, I got it, you know, and I thought they were okay. But to me, it was just, they were a little too raw and unpolished, like not in a good way. Like they sounded like if the Rolling Stones played metal almost, you know, like they kind of had like a bit of that. And now like I appreciate that more and I do give them credit, but I wouldn't say I'm like the biggest fan. Like, they're just a band that I appreciate now more.
And now metal's in a really good place.
I think so. Yeah. I think so.
What are you listening to these days?
Well, you know, I got to call them out here cause I just finished doing the new album, The Sword.
Yeah, I love The Sword.
Yeah.
I remember I got the first Sword album. I don't remember who turned me on to it.
Age of Winners?
Yeah. It was when it came out. I'm trying to remember who turned me on to it. I feel like I thought you on to it.
No, I think I turned...
You turned me on to it?
Yeah, because it was when I was at Upper Deck.
Yeah.
And we were talking...
You were trying to get me
into Mastodon.
Yeah.
And I was trying to turn you on to The Sword.
Okay.
Because I was talking about the more.
All right. So I was turning you on to Mastodon. Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Well, yeah, that opened the whole world because that metal I just can't get
into. Well, you turned me on to Down, too. Because I was talking to you about COC.
Right, right. COC, though, man. I think anything Pepper does.
Yeah. The guy's a genius.
Yeah. I would love to get him on here.
Oh. Just let me be a fly on the wall for that one.
I will. Anything we missed that you wanted to talk about?
Did I turn you on to Black Cobra yet?
No.
Check those guys out. It's a two-piece.
Okay.
Literally a guitar player and a drummer. And I'm doing their album cover right now.
Nice.
And it's like, I don't even know how to describe it. They're not black metal. they're not death metal, but it's on the edge of that.
Okay.
A little bit, almost like scream core, but not, it's still got, it's still rhythmic and it's still, there's still like a song structure and everything.
Okay.
And,
what's strange to me is all really there's all good. These subgenres of metal. I can't keep up with it all.
I can't. And I mean, like I was telling you last night, you know, like I, and you and Becky, you know, like I'm a child of the 70s. So sure. I still like understanding the vocals. I still like a guy that can sing or a girl that can sing.
Yeah, you know, I'm with you. That's what I love about Mastodon.
And I love guitar solos.
Yeah,
so.
yeah.
It's hard not to love this.
Totally. Yeah. All right, you want to promote any of your stuff, your websites, social networking, any of that jazz?
Yeah, I'm on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. As I mentioned earlier today, I'm a huge Rush fan. So if you ever look for Ged Lee on any social media, you'll probably find me.
That's the name you go under.
Yeah, and Jack's Secret is jack-secret.com.
So you have a website for that?
We have a website. The stuff up there is kind of old, but we're getting ready to change it up because I think we're pretty close to getting the first book published.
Okay.
And then look for me monthly on Green Lantern.
Okay.
So.
All right. Thanks, Mark.
Yeah. Thanks, Sean.